It's time for some Trailblazing Justice, the weekly podcast where we discuss civil rights surrounding the criminal legal system in Oregon and beyond. Trailblazing Justice is a production of the Oregon Justice Resource Center. Episode 51, Compassionate Release. Did you know that Oregon already had a process for allowing a terminally ill person to be released from prison to live out their final days in the care of loved ones? Did you also know that that process is horribly broken? That over 90% of terminally ill people in prison who are waiting for their compassionate release request to be heard end up dying before their application ever even gets approved? Bobbin, Zach, Justin, Julia, and Kyle discuss the compassionate release process as it stands now and how it needs to be reformed. You'll hear from a longtime prison hospice volunteer and from those who have worked for years to reform the way that Oregon treats its terminally ill prisoners. I'm Todd Davila, producer of the podcast. Thank you for listening.
Well, welcome back to another episode of Trailblazing Justice. My name is Bobbin Singh. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center. And today we have a full room where, as Todd mentioned in our last episode, we're in our new conference room studio. And we're trying it out, and it seems like it's nice to be able to sit in a conference room across from everyone and talk to people about these issues. But today we're joined by Zach Winston, the Director of Policy and Outreach, Julia Yoshimoto, who is the Director of the Women's Justice Project and Special Advisor to the organization, Justin Lowe, who's Associate Director of Policy and Outreach, and Kyle Hedquist, who is in the midst of a road tour, but he's our Policy Associate. And I say he's in the midst of a road tour. I can't remember what parts of Oregon he was in, but he was somewhere, and there's a picture of him on our social media eating a cinnamon roll. It looks fantastic, but he may be in your neck of the woods soon, so keep an eye out, and I hope you get to meet him as he's out there touring the state and getting to know people and talking about issues related to criminal justice. Today, our topic's going to be talking about compassionate release, but before we do so, we'll head into our news article of the week. And oh, as always, we're thankful for Todd Davila for producing our podcast and making us sound good, taking out all the ohs, all the nonsense that we say and making us sound professional. Thanks to Todd for getting us going each week. News article, what do you have for us, Zach?
I often complain about media and their role in...
It's not complaining, it's constructive criticism.
Constructive criticism. Yes. Sometimes it's complaining. My wife would say it's complaining, but I oftentimes... Media, and I mean media generally, is, whether it's intentional or unintentional, driving certain narratives. And obviously, I think we all know with metrics the way they are these days, they're driving, you know, oftentimes driving clicks, which drive revenue, which keeps media stations in business. So, I mean, I guess it's, you know, somewhat of a necessary evil. But anyway, the article, and it's kind of just the news of the day, there was a shooting in downtown Portland, roughly around the Target.
Well, near our offices.
Yeah, near our offices.
It's across from the New Ritz.
There you go. Right across from the New Ritz is a perfect way to describe it. And so across from the New Ritz, there was a shooting. And so obviously, with it being near our office, we knew about it relatively quickly. And, you know, following, you know, I did a little bit of following on Twitter, following in kind of the various different news articles and what was coming out. And it seems that it was pretty clear from the beginning in terms of statements made by witnesses who talked to the media that this was a road rage incident. Curiously, that was left out of both the headlines on Twitter, for example, and in the articles, really, until they were updated several hours later. And even then, it was buried in the middle of a paragraph in one or two sentences. And I just think that, to me, it felt a little bit like the click is, oh, there's a shooting in downtown Portland. Everyone should be fearful. This is, and really leaning into maybe potentially the narrative that has been kind of spun by media that downtown is dangerous, that it's probably drug related, that it's, you know, this is just a continuation of is, you know.
Well, and also people for Portland, like the narrative, right. People for Portland and sort of like the tough on crime crowd. Yeah. It's this vicious cycle. They've created like this perception that people believe Portland to be unsafe. The media needs those clicks and because that's what people want to reaffirm that message. So, yeah. And I think what was also interesting, because it was near our office, I was paying special attention to it because we still had staff here that were proximate to the incident and, you know, trying to pay attention to it. And there wasn't any Twitter feeds, like, you know, like I didn't really see any feeds initially. And then I started seeing some reporting And then it was like, to me, in my mind, I was like, well, what was this? Was this an incident that involved people that were, you know, was it drug related, mental health related? Was it stranger violence? Was it people that knew each other? Just trying to figure out, you know, the level of risk that was associated with this and the safety for, you know, the people in our office. And yeah, it did become clear. This was a highly circumstantial incident. It was clearly a road rage incident. It involved someone from the West Hills, someone that worked in finance. The person also turned himself in, I think drove a few blocks and turned himself in. So it wasn't, you know, this idea that there was like someone out there with a high risk to the population or anything like that. But it was all sort of like hidden. Like it wasn't obvious within like the first hours of the incident.
Right. Despite, you know, what I saw, and I think one of the, and it's hard because, you know, these versions get updated. And I think at least for the Oregonian, I don't necessarily always see them saying it was updated with X, Y, or Z. It may just say updated at this time, but not
right
listing what the actual update was. And so if I remember correctly, I think I read an article where they had a quote, a statement from a witness who said, you know, well, I drove up, I thought it was really odd that people were getting out of their car, you know, this person was getting out of their car with the door open, but I don't know that that would drive the clicks as much as, you know, just another shooting trying to, I think, at least support, like you said, Bob, in the kind of the narrative that people from Portland and others have kind of spun, which is, you know, probably drug or homeless related, because those are the villains in their narrative, in their story of Portland.
Yeah, and I don't know like how quickly the articles were updated, but I think the first articles that I did see sort of suggested this was like random violence, adding, you know, building on sort of like that perception that people of Portland and others have kind of created about the chaos and the safety risks that are associated with downtown. There's that old saying, if it bleeds, it leads. It seems like now with Portland, not only to get like local clicks, but because New York Times, these other national outlets have really sort of bought into this narrative and really playing up the safety issue and the Measure 110 and how that's related to like public safety. It seems like people from outside are really sort of clicking and sort of like helping to reaffirm that message. I remember reading an article, I think earlier this week, about an out-of-town couple that came in. They parked in a parking deck, and I think their car got broken into. I think at least in that initial one, nothing was stolen, but then they moved their car again, and then it got broken into again, and all their camping stuff was stolen. And they just talked about like how terrible the experience was and how they'll never come back to Portland, and totally agree. I mean, like, I don't want my car broken into. I don't want other people's cars broken into. I don't want people feeling unsafe when they're downtown. I think the shooting incident that happened was terrible and scary, honestly. I mean, it was scary for the people that were here, our staff and things like that. Like I was, you know, concerned about it. But again, it's playing, like of all the stories that are happening in Portland, that's, you know, they pick this one random one out of towner and like playing to the fears of to out of towners, don't come to Portland, right? And to be honest, you go to any major metropolitan city, you park your car with a bunch of stuff in it, there's a high likelihood that it's going to get broken into. I've had my car broken into when I was living in Atlanta, like multiple times, because I just left stuff visible and it was like super easy. And I know other people have. So, yeah, you know, so I don't know how much of it was Portland has a lot of crime versus like, you know, there's just some common sense things to do when you move, you know, come into a city. And unfortunately, that kind of crime just exists.
Yeah, I mean, my mom was in town and one of the conversations we had is like, there's been crime from the beginning of time. Like that's like, there's been quote crime, different ways to define what crime is, but like, you know, unfortunately,
societal harm, people have broken the social contract,
the social contract that some would argue is a structure of white supremacy, at least in the current
construction. I like the tie-in.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the interesting things, you know, so I text Justin and I say, you know, it's interesting how there's little focus there, you know, at least on Twitter's not the best place to be going for like, you know, nuanced conversations on things, but it's just, it's an interesting place. It's kind of an interesting.
Zach, that's where I have all my nuanced
conversations. Yes, I'm very well aware of that. But, you know, there's a gun involved. There's just this interesting overlooking of what the mechanism was that was used to commit this, you know, this act and alleged act, I should say. And anyway, it's amazing how there's this ability to just overlook the fact that, like, you know, the political structure, the political will of Oregon has done some work on that, but hasn't been able to really maybe go far enough on in that area in terms of you know, gun control. So it's, yeah, it just further frustrates me about it, kind of how narratives are.
It is interesting. Like, I mean, that is, I don't know, Justin or Kyle or Joy, if you have anything to say, but like, you know, this was someone that was well off. I mean, it seemed like he had some sort of troubled history with his businesses and things like that, but seemingly well off, lived in a good part of town. He was, it seemed like a legal owner of a gun, four guns.
Four firearms.
But like, that interestingly hasn't really surfaced as part of the conversation. Like, if this person didn't have a gun, this wouldn't have happened. Like, there would have been a road rage incident, people would have yelled at each other and gone off, but the fact that he had a gun that he was driving around with, and why people feel they need to have a gun when they're driving around. I mean, this is the whole reason, right? You don't want people who are emotionally sort of triggered to be able to have access to these types of weapons. Well, separate conversation, yes.
Sure.
But in this instance, like, a civilian, right? And Justin, Kyle?
I mean, I think that you hit on a really good point, and this is what kind of sparked a really good conversation between Zach and I when he brought this point up. I mean, I don't know about anyone else, but driving around in Portland or just really any part in the metro area can just be frustrating in general. I've had many people say that Oregonian drivers are very unique drivers and can elicit a sense of frustration at time. And so I think, you know, to Bobbin's point,
we should dig deeper into that.
We should dig deeper. I think that we can. Oh, we might need to do some significant research and prep for that. We could plan that.
I can understand it. Like, we live in rain for like 8-9 months a year, but when it rains, it seems like people like freak out, you know. Anyways, it's separate.
Well, you know,
and then when the sun comes out, it's like, anyways.
Well, we'll touch on that in a future podcast episode. But I think that goes to the deeper point. And, you know, I think that we've experienced this since the pandemic too. Like, there's just people being reintroduced to society after being locked down, relearning social niceties and everything. And I think that the whole entire world experienced that because the entire like planet was locked down. But then you throw into the mix that we are a very unique country in the sense that we have a huge proliferation of firearms. I think there are statistics that say firearms outnumber us 3-1 or something like that, or maybe even more than that. But when you have an item that could instantly take someone's life away and it's thrown into the mix of a very fraught societal time, people relearning social niceties, or even just driving where like it can be frustrating pre and post pandemic. And then you take into account any other event that could just like upset someone. And now we have easily accessible items that can cause death. There should be a really good and like robust conversation on that. And one is not being had. And it's very frustrating that point gets buried due to the headlines and then just the nuanced or not nuanced conversations that happen on Twitter. I mean, even when I looked at some of the responses on social media, trying to fact check people who had posted saying that, oh, Portland's in shambles, another shooting, and someone saying, well, it was a road rage, that got like buried and even like combated by other folks trying to say, oh, you don't know that. And someone's saying, well, there's an eyewitness account. And they're like, oh, well, that's fake.
Yeah. I mean, people just want to reaffirm their own narratives. And as we talk about this, I don't want to understate sort of the tragedy that occurred because someone died.
Absolutely not.
And it was like really because of this person that had access to this weapon and was in whatever emotional state of mind. And it may not have been like, I mean, Julia and I were talking about this. It may not have been like in the moment. It could have been like months that this person, whatever was happening in this person's lives, just like led to this moment of like pure frustration and anger. But to your point, Justin, like then having access to something that's lethal, being brought, put into the mix is really scary. And I think the other victim who I think survived, you know, was, they were saying, I think I read he was part of like the Oregon Minorities Architect meeting that was happening at the hotel. And he started filming it because he saw what happened in the person shot.
Oh.
So that's what, you know, I read in the news article. Whether or not that's still true or not, we'll have to double check. But again, to your point, like how something lethal being thrown into the mix, how tragic things can turn like very quickly. And I think coming out of the pandemic too, since I think the Trump presidency, even people for Portland sort of building on this, there is this permission to be angry and permission to be like, that was sort of unleashed to be violent and think violent things about people, or, you know, engage in very hostile acts against people. And that was okay. Like, Trump sort of allowed that to happen in the political discourse. And I don't know, it just seemed like there's all of a sudden people felt entitled that they could just do things, right. You know, very aggressive things to individuals. And that feels like kind of where we're at. And people, this is, I think, the danger with People for Portland. And, you know, I think Kevin Barton did this in his election when he was running for DA. Like, he was stoking those embers of, like, you know, Washington, we don't want Washington County to be like Portland, and kind of, you know, dumping on and creating sort of like this hostility. People for Portland doing that. I don't think they fully appreciate exactly, you know, how dangerous, you know, stoking those flames can be. And so,
or they do, and the benefit outweighs them.
Yeah, I mean,
sure,
it scares me. Like, honestly, like, the things that they're saying, and sort of like the people, the segments of the population that they're motivating, which is, you know, now like far right, extremist, violent people who are, you know, very, very pro Second Amendment. I mean, and I says they're not pro Second Amendment. What they are is pro gun.
Right.
Let's be clear.
Pro gun.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
I think one thing that I saw is the narrative that the downtown area is somehow unsafe. And I've been traveling around Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, very small towns, and that same narrative, when something like this happens, gets transferred to a small downtown area like Roseburg or a small downtown area of Lakeview, which are struggling to come out of the pandemic. Many businesses closed, you know, throughout the nation, throughout the world. And a lot of these downtown areas of small towns are struggling to get back. And so if people hear stories, doesn't matter what city it's from, that a downtown area is dangerous, you're actually hurting downtown businesses. You're hurting the small communities. I was just in Roseburg and Grants Pass, incredible little towns, very small towns, and their downtown areas are really cool. You get unique homemade restaurants, good food, good local goods that are made, and we need to be funneling people to these downtown areas. I was out in Lakeview, and they're having a real struggle to get businesses to come back to Lakeview. It's a very, very small town. But when you go downtown, it is one of the coolest little time capsules. So we don't want to deter the idea that every downtown city is somehow full of homelessness and dangerous people and drug addicts, because that's just not accurate.
I never thought about that. I actually thought it would be like the inverse, where people are saying, stay away from Portland. Come visit our little town. It's safe and clean. And, you know, we don't have these issues, because we often find in these smaller cities and municipalities and counties, like, a little bit more aggressive actions toward homelessness or whatever. So they tend not to be as present as they are in Portland.
They also don't have all the services. I mean, that's like the thing about cities.
Yeah.
Coming from New York, right? So I agree with you. You said it a couple minutes ago that coming from Atlanta, that you car broken into. I mean, it's a city. There's more people packed into a much denser area. Anyway,
I totally agree. I heard from people in Roseburg. They knew I was from Salem. They knew I was, you know, working with OJRC in Portland area. People 2 days ago told me that don't go downtown. They're talking about Roseburg because it's full of homeless and drug addicts. Well, I went downtown. I had an interview with a local newspaper. It was wonderful. The city, the street lights were lit up. The trees had lights in them. The businesses were open. We went to a cool restaurant. I did not see what people told me I would see. Now, I'm not saying there's not homeless people and people that are battling addiction in the city of Roseburg. I just did not see what people told me I was going to see.
Yeah.
Sure. Which seems to be a product of the national, what's happening nationally, which is like the facts aren't, you know, the rhetoric isn't matching the reality.
True.
The talking points aren't matching the reality. And yet that doesn't seem to stop.
Yeah. And another layer to this is, like, you know, people talk about, like, why the downtown, like, especially downtown Portland, isn't as it was prior to COVID. It's because most of the people who work downtown went and worked at home. And a lot of these large companies decided that's cheaper than and working just as well than and cheaper than having a bunch of office space downtown. So we're just going to keep people at home. So thousands of people are no longer working downtown and, you know, are coming downtown. And so whether or not like the homeless population or the individuals on the street that are battling addiction or whatever it is has actually increased, maybe, probably, it seems like that's true, but they're also more visible because there's just less people downtown. And so, and you know, the thing that I think it speaks also highly to like the livability of the region, because you have a lot of really nice neighborhoods around the Portland area that people are okay just being in those areas. So, you know, there's, it's all to say it's like complicated kind of factors in the downtown stuff. But again, going back to the original sort of article about sort of what's, you know, you have that, but then you have like this narrative that keeps getting affirmed that the downtown areas aren't safe and you shouldn't be there. And I don't know. And that, and I think that article didn't, at least the initial sort of reporting of it, didn't help.
Either. Yeah. You know, it was all the article. A, it's a rush to publish, right? Because again, clicks, mm-hmm. but then also, you know, there should be, I think, responsibility for, and this goes to like, what does the media see their responsibility? Is it getting the news out as quickly as possible, or is it getting it right and not, you know, playing into the narrative that, you know, people from Portland and other groups
want to really... I mean, the local media here, not all of it, but generally speaking, the media is complicit in sort of helping affirm these false narratives about the city and going after what's, you know, what people click on and things like that. I mean, if the interest was really about safety, I mean, one of the things you'd want to report, at least initially, is obviously this was like a road rage incident. People knew that from the outset. I think within a short amount of time, the person turned himself in. I mean, you would want to get that information out to the public so people in this area knew that it was safe. That would be the priority.
Right.
It didn't feel like it. You know, no. It didn't feel like that was the priority.
Yeah. When discussing the downtown environment and, you know, feeling safe downtown, and I lived at 3rd and Jefferson for a while, I felt much more unsafe walking by drunk college kids than I did, unfortunately, having to pass individuals who were houseless. 100% I would cross the street if there was a group of drunk college kids. I just, you know, I think that...
Not just college kids. I would say, like, drunk, like anywhere in the 20 to 30. There's a group of, like, young, inebriated people.
That's a good point. Yes. College is, like, an age identifier. But, yes, I mean, that younger... I mean, that's... To me, that is much... I feel much more unsafe there than with someone who's... Yeah. So, anyway, I just think that's an important piece. And
I think what it comes down to is that it's unpleasant. Right. It's unpleasant for people to like see this. It's unpleasant for people to have to see people in not good circumstances, homeless, battling addiction, struggling with mental health, whatever it may be, any combination of maybe one singular thing. But seeing that openly and publicly, it's very, very hard. And I think when people see that, it's just more easy to associate danger and kind of stay away from it than actually think about how we gotten to this point, you know, like what are the structures or the lack of infrastructure that and resources and care that allowed us to that this is happening on our streets and in this scale, you know. So,
you know, we always need to be careful with what makes quote society uncomfortable, because what made society uncomfortable years ago. Mm-hmm. People, well, and today, but you know that there the justification for marginalizing and mm-hmm. Vulnerable and quote unquote different people who are different, it continues to play out today, mm-hmm. where people say this is not what I want my city to be like.
Yep.
You hear that a lot. So anyway, I just think that, you know, and I've had this conversation with plenty of individuals who, you know, kind of identify as progressive and generally are aligned, and you know, well, I don't want to see that. Okay, but. There's a lot of things I don't want to see, but, you know, that doesn't mean I get my way, and it doesn't also mean that it's right. Right. So anyway, just an important piece to remember.
But we should delve into what do you not want to see, Zach?
Yeah. Oh, that's one thing I want to see. People for Portland's one of them.
I don't think I want to see that either. Well, it was a good article and a good topic to discuss, but and we'll come back to it. I think, like, the media reporting and crime and stuff like that is hugely important in the work that we do, because we're often combating, you know, narratives and mythologies and stereotypes, which I think is a good segue into the compassionate release conversation, because over the past three decades, we've built up five decades. Like, I'm aging myself now. Like, I think when I say the '80s, I still think we're like in the early 2000s or whatever. But anyways, since the 1980s, like, we've just built up this carceral system. It's gotten so massive, and it's built on sort of these narratives and stereotypes about, you know, you do the crime, you do the time, and, you know, these mandatory minimum sentences. And, you know, one of the things that I think every state, and especially Oregon, is struggling with is the result of those policies being driven off of those stereotypes and mythologies. And as an aging population, it's a population that's, you know, that has medical issues. And we have, you know, a segment of the population within the carceral system that's not well. And there's no really viable relief for them to get out. Historically, there's been a mechanism known as compassionate release, which is the ability for individuals to be able to get out of the carceral setting, out of prison, and to be able to do the remainder of their time in the community if they're suffering from a chronic illness, if they're terminally ill, if incarceration basically doesn't make any sense, hence the term compassionate release. It's meant to be compassionate. And, you know, largely these individuals are public safety risks because of the type of ailment that they're suffering through. But, you know, going back again to these stereotypes and mythologies, like, even in these situations, we find in our state, like, people aren't compassionate. There's still this fear that this person should basically die in prison, should suffer, and we can't let them out for the fear, what if this person actually is tricking us? I remember in one legislative hearing in compassionate release, one legislator alluded to the fact that someone could fake brain cancer to try to get out on compassionate release, which was new to me as far as, like, you know, as far as the level of discourse is where we got to. But it was stunning to think that someone is driven again by fear. But I guess let's just back up. So compassionate release, we have it in the books here in Oregon in theory. It's a very narrow policy that only very few people can, if any, can benefit from. Everyone here in this conversation has been sort of intimately involved in the compassionate release push over the past several years. But before we sort of jump into, like, the work that we've been doing, Kyle was just happened to be in the office today, stopping off to pick up some stuff. And I kind of pulled him into this podcast because Kyle actually spent time working with people in custody that were in the hospice program. Kyle, could you talk to us a little bit about, like, your experiences of working with people in hospice, what you saw, like, the medical kind of issues that people are confronting and things like that?
Yeah, the hospice program at OSP basically got started 1999, so it was the late 90s, and into the 2000s. And initially, we saw a lot of folks that were suffering from hepatitis C infection, a few HIV, and a lot of cancer. That was our primary ailments. And not all of these people were elderly. You know, when we think about compassionate release, sometimes we think about elderly folks. But nonetheless, these are terminally ill prisoners. They have seen medical professionals. They are transported outside of the prison, evaluated, and have been deemed terminally ill. And the prison system is not equipped. It's not a medical facility. There's no prison in Oregon that has the necessary staffing, equipment to actually be a medical facility, which is why they get transferred out, which is why we have such a high cost associated with it. Secondly, these people require various types of medications. They might require IV transfusions. It's a very complicated, you know, setting, and yet you're incarcerated. The one thing that surprised me was that people that are veterans, people that are, you know, have retirement systems or insurance systems, they're not able to access those benefits while they're incarcerated. So the cost is directly passed on to the prison system. And now you multiply that over the last 20 years, and you have dozens and dozens of men and women that are not only getting older, they're suffering from cancer, they're suffering from the same ailments that we suffer from in the community, and they're getting to a point where they are medically deemed terminally ill. Some of them have 6 months left. Some of them, by the time they see the doctor, they are passing away within 60 days. And because of the strict security protocols of the prison system, being able to access visiting is very difficult because these individuals can't go to the visiting room, which is the authorized place for family to come see them. And so children are not allowed to enter the prison. Visitors are very rarely allowed to enter the prison infirmary because it's located inside the actual prison. And so now you have men and women who are alone, without family, unable to say their goodbyes to their children, their parents, and they die. And I have never seen anyone miraculously recover, as was alluded to during the last session. There was fear that terminal people would be released and somehow there would be miracle treatments that would allow them to be healed, and now they would be free in society and not being held accountable for their crimes. I was a hospice volunteer for 22 years and I never saw that happen one time.
You know, one of the things is what sort of stuns me is if we accept the premise, and which I don't, I want to be very clear, that we live in like a punishment sort of paradigm kind of system, or we should, and that people should be held accountable in these prisons. These prisons and these in the circumstances in which people live in, the way people are treated is a reflection of our value system, our communal value system, our societal value systems. It has no reflection on the individuals that are there. So if we accept that people are there and these are the conditions that they're living in, to me, I find it even still extraordinary that even under those circumstances, if we were to accept that people who are terminally ill, who are dying, that we still don't bestow them the dignity of being able to be comforted by their loved ones or family members or to die with some dignity or grace, but instead in isolation, it sounds like. Just from your experience, I mean, how 22 years is a very long time. And not all the prisons has hospice programs, just a few of them, so they get transferred into them, right, yep, from other prisons. I mean, how did you manage that for 22 years, like seeing that and just working in that environment?
Well, it was very difficult. And really, when the program first started, it started at Oregon State Penitentiary. And for probably 10 years, we were the only prison that had hospice. And so all of the terminally ill prisoners came to OSP, the infirmary, which is a very small room. It has about 20 beds. There's curtains in between the beds that can be pulled, but it's a very old school, something you would see in an old prison movie. Well, OSP is an old prison, and that's what it was. It was so open
like,
air.
It's like open, 20 beds, people all next to each other. Yeah.
They line the walls. They line three walls. And you know, the structure itself is not comforting. The structure is not made for compassion. The structure of the infirmary is meant for security.
Are people handcuffed?
They're not handcuffed while they're housed in the infirmary because it's located inside the prison. But if they are transported, and I'll tell you what, I have had to go down to the R&D area, which is receiving and discharge, to help handcuff terminally ill patients so that they can be medically transported to a hospital. And some of them, I didn't know if they were going to make it to the hospital because they were so sick. But the reason they were being transferred is because we just didn't have the facility to care for these individuals. So this is a high risk person who is literally dying.
High risk meaning medically high risk.
Medical high risk. They can't stand. They can't walk. I'm having to lift them with gait belts and turn them and roll them over on gurneys so that we can put belly chains around them to transport them. There's no way that this person could stand up, and yet they're being transported in belly chains, leg shackles, and handcuffs.
And so, you know, going back to like the room, the facility, so you have doctors, nurses, individuals like yourself who are working with individuals in the program, but like you said, no access to family or friends. So what, I mean, at all, like, so family cannot visit at all?
There were a few exceptions, but very rarely. And if the family, you know, hired an attorney, or if the family somehow knew somebody that was influential in the Department of Corrections or influential in the state, maybe they could make some phone calls. But in all those years, I would say 5 or 6 terminally ill patients were actually able, while they were in the infirmary, to have their family come in and visit them. It was very, very rare, very complicated. And if it did happen, it was a one-time thing. They weren't able to visit the normal visiting hours, which is 7 days a week. The family cannot, you're not coming into the infirmary 7 days a week to visit your dying loved one. You might get in one time before they pass away.
Yeah, I think that's the important piece, right? Oftentimes, if there is an exception, which is also, again, as you said, very rare, it's oftentimes at the very end of life. So, you know, when the individual may not even recognize or even be able to.
Can't carry on a conversation.
Right.
You're throwing up. You're bleeding. You're at the end stages. Right. You are in the beginning stages of death, and a family is brought in this open air environment. So other prisoners,
there's no privacy.
I mean, you might have a prisoner up there that broke their arm yesterday on the basketball court, and they're right next to a person who has terminal cancer and is bleeding and requires full attention. I was a volunteer. I didn't get paid to do this. And there would be a whole group of us, sometimes 3 or 4 at a time, caring for individuals. And right next to them is a guy with a broken arm from a basketball game. And having to sit next to this and listen to it, and it was very, very traumatic.
And this isn't families who have been able to, like, you know, every week come in oftentimes, right? It's you fought your way in, and it's oftentimes granted right at the very end of life.
Right.
This isn't a, you know, continuing visitation.
It's actually not compassionate.
No.
You're bringing people in at the very end of a life. It's highly traumatic. Everybody's crying. I would be crying. The nurses would be crying. The doctors would be. I mean, it was emotionally charged, and then it was, then you're escorted out, and then what? He's left to sit with all that emotion.
Can you add a little bit more detail for us? So, as far as like, what kind of food are they eating? Are they eating the same sort of like prison food? Are they given like special diets? We live in an age of tablets now, right, and video conferencing. Are people able to access, like, so, you know, any of that stuff?
Interestingly enough, I was just released a year and a half ago. So I kind of know the layout of the infirmary, and they finally put in what they call a video kiosk, which is a locked steel box with basically a tablet locked in that you can touch screen for visiting. However, that is a solid bolted to the ground unit. So if someone is laying in bed, there's no way to access that tablet. It's not available to walk around with. They don't have...
Which is sort of like the function of a tablet,
which
right?
is the function of a tablet. When people think of a tablet in this world, as I'm learning, they're not thinking of a locked box bolted to a ground that you have to kind of sit in front of to maneuver. It's not wheelchair friendly, obviously. And while there are telephone access, cordless phones, there's only a couple of them. You can't really, you're under the same rules. So you have a 20-minute time limit. You're able to make a call. If someone else wants to use the phone, you have to navigate that process. It costs money. Your family, oftentimes, if you're terminally ill, you're not working a prison job. So you're not able to contribute and put your prison wages, $30 to $50, on your phone. So now your family is having to put money on your phone just so you can talk to them before you die, which is just that statement alone is mind-boggling.
And now we have this new phone validation.
Right, and that's if their phone number's been validated, which can be a complicated process.
Yeah,
it requires 20, a credit card.
20 steps and a credit card and all this other stuff, yeah.
And if you have T-Mobile, there's additional steps.
Of course.
You know, one last question before we get into like a little bit more broader conversation about compassionateness. And I really do appreciate you kind of sharing, you know, your experiences and like what you saw in there. You know, for me, if I have a medical issue, even if I'm sick, like I get very private because I feel like you feel vulnerable, you know, like you don't feel like yourself. You're having things happen that don't feel great. And you kind of like want to retreat a little bit. And even if I go to the hospital for an emergency, I'm like, I want my own space. My, you know, I want to be behind, it feels like you just feel exposed. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do people manage like being in that environment like that? How do you manage like even just being a volunteer, interacting with people when they're that, you know, that exposed and that, you know, being in those conditions?
The prison hospice program was really an opportunity to see true compassion because people were in a vulnerable state. One thing that we were constantly vigilant on is here is a person who's dying. Well, they are surrounded by whatever property they've accumulated while they've been incarcerated. And so people are constantly maybe trying to come over and borrow something, maybe trying to come over and take something, you know, come over and use something. So not only is this person in a vulnerable position, but they have no privacy. They really don't have their own security. And as people progressed, we actually, as volunteers, stayed with them 24 hours a day, just so we could not only comfort them, but so they would feel that sense of security. There's no doors. There's no locks. This person is sleeping. This person is throwing up. This person has, you know, suffering through these medical conditions. And, you know, because the one nurse on duty has other patients to take care of, as well as hand out medication to the entire prison of 2,000 population, they're not on the floor. They're not. They don't have the time or resources to sit next to someone while they're dying for 24 hours a day. So that was really left to us to do. And we really came together as a community and were able to provide that space where somebody could die, maybe with some peace, maybe with some dignity, try as we might. But most often it was really just a sad, heartbreaking scenario.
That sounds terrible. I mean, and if you were to try to envision something that's the opposite of compassionate, I think you've painted a picture of what that looks like. And, you know, the lack of dignity, you know, and again, Kyle, I really appreciate you sharing that. I know it's not easy, you know, spending all that time that you did with these individuals in these moments and just being in that environment. I know it can be challenging to like think about those things, you know, but, you know, this leads us to like the bigger question of like, this is what exists here in Oregon. And when we talk about compassionate release, we're not just talking about potentially terminally ill people, but people who are medically compromised or physically compromised, people, you know, for whatever reason, the incarceration environment doesn't make sense. And that, you know, it would be better to have them out in the community to have treatment, support, services, you know, they're not a public safety risk, whatever it may be, but that's what we're talking about. So this is just like one population. But I think the way that we came to compassionate release and really started digging into it was during COVID. Like, we were trying to look for mechanisms of getting people out of prison that shouldn't be there, especially medically vulnerable people, because at that time there was no vaccine. COVID was scary. The world literally shut down. And we knew in these like highly dense settings, these congregate settings, that the vulnerability that COVID, how quickly COVID can spread and how vulnerable people can be, especially if they're medically vulnerable, how that could lead to lethal outcomes. So during that time, we started exploring what are the mechanisms. And one of the things that we did that Julia actually led was filing a mandamus with the Oregon Supreme Court, because we learned about the compassionate release statutes here. And we felt the Board of Parole could actually release people. If you read the statute, we felt like the Board of Parole could and should be able to release people, but they weren't. But Julia, do you want to talk a little bit about like what did you learn about at that time, and why did we file the mandamus? And I mean, just kind of like a general high level overview of the laws, and then sort of what we began to understand about the narrowness of compassionate release.
Yeah, the reason that we looked at the compassionate release option is because the statute itself and the language itself seem pretty open to giving the board authority to release people. The language in the statute actually has a sense of compassion in it, and it is surprising how little it is used given what the intent of it seems to have been from the legislature.
And in Oregon, you said the board. So the Board of Parole is the one that has the authority to release
right.
people.
So under the statute, the Board of Parole is the deciding authority in terms of who gets released under compassionate release. In part, the reason why compassionate release is so little used is because of our sentencing laws. So if you have a mandatory minimum sentencing law sentence, basically And generally speaking, you're not going to be eligible for a compassionate release. But when you look at the statute for a compassionate release, the things that the board is supposed to be considering is whether or not continued incarceration is going to be cruel and unusual and or cruel and inhumane. And if it is continuing to confine the individual is incompatible with the best interests of the prisoner and society. And so that seems to lend itself to very compassionate decision making. Mm-hmm. And when it at the time of COVID, you know, there were going to be a number of people. We were looking for what mechanisms were going to be allowed under law to release people, yeah, because it was such a dire situation. People living, you know, in just communal settings with this very contagious.
And just to be clear, like we were looking at mechanisms early on, like when COVID first hit and came and things were shutting down, because we were concerned about once COVID got into the prisons, the waves that would happen of infections and deaths. So we weren't looking at this just to, as a chronology, like we weren't looking at this after COVID started spreading. We were looking at this like in April and May, like as soon as
the prison was shutting down and, you know, America was realizing that COVID was a global pandemic and everyone was going to be impacted by it. And the other thing that, you know, we're very cognizant of is that the medical care in prison is very poor. And so there are a lot of individuals, if not majority of the individuals, that were qualifying as medically vulnerable to this disease. And it was unknown the consequences, you know, it was, you know, as extreme as death for people to catch COVID. So it seemed like a statewide emergency. It seemed incumbent upon state leaders and state actors who had authority to act on that and protect people and keep people safe. And so looking at the statute and what was available as authority for the board, that's why we filed the mandamus, because we believed that the board could do this. There were going to be a lot of people that weren't under mandatory minimum sentences, that given the circumstances that we were in, these unprecedented circumstances for medically vulnerable people, it just sort of seemed like we were showing the state how they could protect mm-hmm. people. And
this is an interesting sort of thing that we tried. This was helped generated by Conrad, who's a paralegal that works on impact stuff and the Youth Justice Project in our organization. But a mandamus is essentially a legal tool which you can file with the courts. You're supposed to start off in the trial court and the circuit court, but in sort of like urgent or extraordinary circumstances, you can go straight to the state Supreme Court, which we did, because we didn't want to wait to go through the circuit court, the court of appeals, and the state Supreme Court. This was a matter that we wanted to get, like, to...
There was a sense of urgency.
Yeah, a sense of urgency. That was clear. We needed to get clarity on whether or not this could happen. And what a mandamus is you go to the courts, and what you're doing is you're asking the courts essentially to have another body or actor comply with the law. So in this instance, we filed the mandamus with the Supreme Court. And what we were asking is the Supreme Court to require the Board of Parole to follow the law, which is how we interpret the statute, which was quite broad, that they had the power to actually release people. So we were saying, Supreme Court, please tell the Board of Parole
to do their job
and release people under the statute. And yeah, so what was the...
So we got enough of interest from the Oregon Supreme Court that they asked for a response from the state. I would say the response from the state did not make a lot of sense to us. It was hard to reply to, but we sort of reiterated our points again in the reply, and ultimately the case was dismissed. Mm-hmm. But in doing this work and sort of digging deeper into...
You dismissed that the Supreme Court didn't grant the mandamus we were asking, yeah.
But it also uncovered for us, I think what a lot of people understood, but we hadn't really looked very closely at this issue, is that compassionate release is very rare. That, you know, I can't even remember the numbers. It's like less than 10 in, you know, like 10 years or something that people are, Oh, do you have the numbers?
Yeah, from
and Justin, I think that's.
I mean, we know that
memorized.
We know that more people die awaiting a decision on their compassionate medical release application than are actually released. And so, just for example, from 2013 to 2020, 131 AICs, adults in custody, with severe medical conditions, applied for compassionate medical release. And then, of those applicants, only 9, so less than 7%, were able to complete the process and were granted release. And then, in that same time period, so 2013 to 2020, 11 applicants passed away while waiting for an outcome. So the average wait time for the 9 successful applications was 167 days. So,
well, and that the number actually sounds higher than the numbers that we received, because when we asked the Board of Parole, we actually requested the numbers. We said, can you please let us know how many applicants? And I think the initial response back from them was like, we don't track this. Right. You know, like, we don't actually track this information.
Yeah, I don't know that I wouldn't trust the accuracy in those numbers, but those are the numbers that we did receive from them.
And the other thing that we learned is that, so the Board of Parole has a lot of different responsibilities and decision-making to do. They are tasked with, making release decisions on people convicted of murder and aggravated murder. They are tasked with categorizing people who have been convicted of sex offenses. Compassionate release is on there. There's other, very wide, they set the terms for post-prison supervision. And so this board has sort of a wide range of different decisions to make, and compassionate release, what we learned is sort of at the bottom of their priority list of things that they're going to work on. The other thing that was very clear and was the question of the backgrounds of the parole board members to be making decisions about whether or not somebody's medical conditions rose to the level that they should be released, that they weren't going to be a risk to the community. I mean, majority of the board members are usually attorneys, oftentimes district attorneys or from district attorney offices, maybe public defenders, POs, it's sort of that kind of background. And it's unclear why that background makes sense for a decision about compassionate release. But I do want to emphasize that a lot of the restriction around who's eligible for compassionate release has to do with our sentencing laws. Mm-hmm.
But also going back to like the board qualifications, I mean, this to me was like the most stunning thing is you had a bunch of people who had absolutely no background in medicine or public health making decisions about compassionate release. Like even the limited decisions that they were making. And I think the other sort of interesting thing that we learned about is that under the current law, DOC is like a participating voice in this, and it puts them in a sort of like a conflict of interest, because DOC can't openly admit that they can't care for individuals, because that's an admission of violating the Eighth Amendment. They're charged, they're constitutionally required to be able to provide, medical care for individuals. So them somehow admitting or like offering up people for compassionate release, which is a statute sort of how it envisions it. I mean, this was also part of our argument that the Board of Parole was basically relying on DOC to make the decisions, and the board would sort of acquiesce to like their recommendations, that, it doesn't make any sense. So this is the reason why the statute's also kind of broken.
Well, that part is in the board rules.
Yeah, in the board rules, sorry, not in law.
Yeah.
And so... So we were saying they were actually delegating their own responsibility to someone else. And again, DOC didn't really have the ability or the background to make these decisions.
It seems like an important chance to say that, while we don't agree with DOC on a lot of things, DOC very much supports compassionate release reform. Mm-hmm. and wants to see that happen, because they're put in a very difficult position. From a non-compassionate point of view, it also costs a ton of money.
Yeah, so... based on this experience with COVID and the mandamus, and I'll say that another interesting point is during COVID, this will be probably a separate conversation, but what we learned too is that there were a number of public actors or public officials or branches of government that could have stepped in and provided relief to individuals incarcerated. Like the Supreme Court could have, if it wanted to, accepted our mandamus and allowed us to do oral arguments and to deliberate on this more, but they decided not to. The governor could have done more. You know, like the legislature could have done more. What we found is that anytime there was an opportunity for a branch of government to step in and kind of intervene, they chose not to, which was very eye-opening and I think a separate conversation that we can talk about. So the mandamus revealing, one, that the compassionate release statute is broken, that this is not being used. Two, that the people making these decisions had no background. I mean, had no business making these decisions or weighing in on it, you know. And that led us to a conversation. I think Julia and I were talking one day, like, why is the board making this decision? And it may have been like over a cup of coffee or something like that. I can't remember. And we're like, why aren't doctors making this decision? And then also prior to COVID, we were bringing in legislators with the group of guys that we work with at OSCI. And one of the AICs there, one of the individuals in custody there, did a presentation on the aging prison population and began sort of planting the seeds for a conversation around what do we have to do with this, with one legislator, Senator Dembro, and how we began to respond to this. So you mix this all together, and we talked to Senator Dembro, and we actually developed a sort of like a concept of, we need to reform compassionate release, and what we should have is independent medical professionals, public health professionals, making objective decisions, and those decisions, those recommendations should be sort of binding. The burden is presumptively binding, unless the Board of Parole, who's more interested in the public safety sort of aspect of stuff, who potentially have, you know, that's where their background is. I don't think the current board has that background to make allegedly, that assessment. Allegedly. If they could come up with a public safety issue to kind of overcome that burden if it was there. And that's how the compassionate release legislation really got sort of started. It was through the mandamus, through the conversations we were having at OSCI with legislators, our own sort of experiences, you know, during COVID and the conversations with Senator Dembro. So enter 2021, Zach comes aboard, and we start meeting with the Board of Parole, I think in late 2020. And, you know, it was really interesting because my initial sort of thoughts, and it was a bit naive, I always do this with policy conversations, I'm like, why would the Board of Parole be opposed to this? Like, this means less work for them, they don't have to make these decisions, and this will be better for everyone, we could actually get a statute. They nominally sort of or superficially agreed that, yeah, we should make some changes or, you know, things aren't working very well. But, man, they were resisted from the outset. We can make this work. Never mind, you know, and fought us. Like, they were just sort of almost like offended by the idea that we had tried to take this power away from them. I mean, so much so that I was so offended that, you know, I couldn't participate in these work groups anymore because it just seemed ridiculous to me that this sort of the pushback that we're getting. What was remarkable, what Zach alluded to, is DOC was like, yes,
please
help. Please do this. Please create this. This makes a lot of sense to us. We're paying, you know, $150,000, $120,000 a month to care for some of these individuals. We can't do it. I mean, he didn't say it like that. I mean, you know, but he's like, it makes more sense. Like, just these people don't need to be in prison. Like, this is not the place for them.
And it's getting worse. As the years go by.
Exactly.
It's not going away because of COVID. The problem existed before COVID, and it's simply getting worse.
Exactly. So to us, it was like, you know, how DOC responded, we were like, the board will respond. Did not happen. Anyways, so that was in 2021. We introduced legislation. Senator Dembro and Rep. Reynolds were sort of the chair of an independent medical advisory committee.
Rep. Reynolds, who's a doctor,
yeah.
Because it's important.
Who's a doctor.
Highlighting that.
So the basics of it is that you have an independent medical advisory committee, we call it the MRAC, that would accept applications. Doesn't matter what your sentence is. They would objectively look at it based on a new criteria. And if they felt like you met that criteria, they would make a recommendation for medical or compassionate release. Then that recommendation could go to the Board of Parole, the courts, to the governor, whatever it may be. Whoever the releasing authority could be, depending on your sentence. If you're under mandatory minimums, the board can't release you. The governor can grant you clemency. You know, maybe there's like an 819 petition that you can get out with, which is a new way of getting out or for early release. But you would have this in your hand that you say, these medical professionals say, based on objectively the conditions, you meet these criteria. You meet this criteria, you should get compassionate release. And all these other entities can say, look, balancing the factors, weight, whatever, society, policy, whatever it may be, we're not going to let you out. But they would have the burden, in theory. Like, that would, this is how we wanted to play it out. So, I don't know, Zach, how did it go in 2021? How did we do?
Well, we're bringing it back.
But what was your sort of, this was your first legislative session. And again, what I would say is, like, this highlights kind of like how OJRC policy develops. It develops through our own experiences, through litigation, representing people, because we represented people in the mandamus, the conversations we were having at OSCI, like this sort of mixture of things that directly resulted from like the client work and the people that we work with, and advocacy. And yeah, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think this the bill in 21 and throughout the sessions, we've brought in every session since, and we'll be bringing it back again in this upcoming session. You know, it's always a difficult conversation. I mean, to Julia's point, what we heard from the board of parole was essentially, we get to these when we get to them. They're very low on our priority list, meaning compassionate release applications. We don't have, I mean, you hear this from any agency, their go-to is, we don't have the resources. Give us more resources and maybe we could talk about getting to some, you know, outcomes that, you know, some adequate and sufficient outcomes. And so, you know, that was kind of the initial response, was how can we make, and we've seen this from other agencies as well, which is, so just to not go into too deep on this, when you have a bill, there is a fiscal that's generated by the Legislative Fiscal Office. And
what this means is essentially, like, you want to introduce this policy, and there's an analysis done whether or not, like, how much it's going to cost the state to basically implement this policy. So it's a fiscal analysis. Some bills have a fiscal, like, in the sense there's a certain amount of money that would be required to implement the policy. Some bills don't. Right.
And the agencies put forward.
Right. You hit the nail on the head there, Julia. Because as Bobbin's saying, some bills sue and some bills don't. And that doesn't always actually line up with what actually costs money and what isn't going to cost money. It often lines up with what do agencies want to kill or block, and what bills do agencies want to let through. Because there's a different path for the bills. If it has a fiscal attached to it, so it's going to cost the state money over a certain amount, then it goes to the Ways and Means Committee, which is a joint committee. Takes a lot longer. It doesn't go straight to the floor. So anyway, it creates significantly more hurdles, as we've seen. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that the issue, there's a lot of issues with kind of the fiscal process in Oregon. And one of them is that they don't, it's only what, first off, the agency puts it forward, as Julia said. And then second, it's only the cost. So even if there's a savings attached to it, like there would be with compassionate release, it's not presented in the fiscal analysis, which is what the legislators view.
In the sense of, like, it will take money to create the committee. It'll right. take money to review. It'll take money just to implement this policy. But what we've learned is that if you let these people out of prison, it's actually cheaper to treat them in the community than it is in the prison. So as a net to the state, it's going to be cheaper.
To the state, and especially to DOC. I mean, to DOC, it's a direct savings for them. And I mean, there was a task force that was conducted that was jointly chaired by DOC and then some medical professionals around corrections health. And one of the notes was, yeah, if you can pass compassionate release reform in the form of the bill that we put forward, that you can fund a lot of our other recommendations in this report with those savings. And I think to be fair, DOC actually acknowledged, you know, they very much realize the fact that, like, their budget is blown out oftentimes by the increasing healthcare costs and the growing population, the aging population in Oregon, which is, as Kyle said, only getting worse. And the longer we allow Measure 11 to exist in Oregon, worse that problem is going to continue to get. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of, so that was a very difficult process because it's we're not in the room where it happens.
The agency makes a fiscal.
When the agency makes a fiscal, we then have to work with the legislator. And you know, Senator Denbrough and Rep. Reynolds have been amazing throughout this entire journey of the compassionate release bill. So we have to rely on them to essentially try to get that, what was submitted. And generally, it's just an Excel spreadsheet that says, yeah, we think it's this, you know, and like.
This is the interesting part, because like they submitted the agency fiscal in 2021. And I think like we asked Denbrough, because we didn't understand it, like the amount that they were saying, right. It didn't make any sense to actually challenge it and interrogate it. And then they submitted this Excel spreadsheet, which was, it just seemed like random numbers on a spreadsheet, sure. You know, like it was just like, well, we'll just put some 6-figure number here, some 7-figure number here. And it didn't make any sense, right?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like the... how the U.S. Supreme Court works, which is you have an answer and then you back your way into it, right? So you have we want it to cost X amount of millions of dollars, because then we know for sure that this is going to be an uphill battle for them, yeah. For the advocates and for the legislators. Okay, how do we get there? Well, if we need, you know, this many staff, and if we need a new board member, and if you're really going to want to have, you know, this many, you know, people part of the MRAC, the new committee, then, you know, well, we're going to have to pay them this, you know, so, and we're going to have to have them staff. We're going to have to give them staff. So, yeah, so very much backed into the fiscal that they wanted. And so that was our first foray into it. I mean, I think that
there 2021, was, we brought it back in 2022.
Yeah, 2022, which was a short session.
And then we brought it back in 2020. Senator Denbrough brought it back in 2023.
2023. And I will say that, you know, we've gotten over the first hurdle, which, so, you know, every the bills will start out in a policy committee. And so 2 of the 3 years we've been in the Judiciary Committee. Last year we were in the Healthcare Committee. And I think this year, I think the hope is, or the plan is, to hopefully be in back in the Judiciary Committee. And that was the Senate Judiciary. And so that... yeah, I mean, it's it'll be interesting. We've made it over the first hurdle, which is the policy committee, generally with plenty of time, and the area that we continuously die in is the Ways and Means Committee, and that's where.
And this last time it was mainly because of the Republican walkout.
You know. We've gotten closer and closer within the Ways and Means Committee, and this last time it definitely felt like we were right there, and then the Republicans walked out. When they eventually came back, there was no room for a large kind of...
And I want to ask Justin a question just here, but like, what's so interesting about this concept and bill, like, because we worked with national partners on this, FAM,
and
Justice Action Network, is... we would be the first state in the country to actually have an independent medical committee sort of involved in the compassionate release process, which is, to me, kind of phenomenal. Like, I mean, if Oregon can do this, this would be great. This is the direction that we need to be heading in. Again, it doesn't make any sense for a bunch of attorneys or corrections officers or former parole officers or business people, you know, making these decisions.
Well, I don't know. When I need my light fixed, I call a plumber. So I don't
know. Well, you know, a plumber is life-saving in many instances. But, yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Like, when you think about it rationally, like, you would never, outside of this situation, allow these people to make decisions like these that involve public health and sort of medical kind of stuff. But Justin, I mean, you came on board in 2023, or just before the 2023 election, you got more involved, you helped create a report on this. I mean, what were your impressions, like, delving into this issue and sort of your impressions with the legislature, the pushback on it?
I think in diving into writing the report, one of the things that I immediately put on my priority list was to reach out, or at least try to identify and locate, individuals who were impacted specifically by either being in the infirmary in one of the DOC facilities or having had some impact or role in the hospice care system there. And to start off with, I think I might note that when I completed my report, I was unable to identify or locate any families or individuals who were connected to a loved one who passed away in the infirmary and hospice. And I think that really emphasizes a point of how sensitive and hard and difficult, like the nature of this topic is, and also, you know, probably the trauma that's involved that then impacts the willingness of anyone being able to or having the capacity to share about these stories. So a lot of the quotes that I have within the report come from individuals who served as hospice volunteers in the infirmary. And a lot of what they recounted, and much of which was informed actually by Kyle and a lot of what he said earlier, essentially fell into the lines that we should not allow folks to die in prison, and especially in this manner. And it makes no sense. And, you know, you've already heard the financial costs that are associated with this. You've heard about the physical ailments. Prison is a harsh and grueling and unforgiving environment. And there are reports and studies that I used in writing my report and research about how you could be 50 years old, you know, chronologically speaking, but you have the biological age, meaning the mental capacities and the physical limitations of someone who's probably in their mid-70s. And that's due to the grind and the grueling conditions of prison. And so, you know, you couple that with the costs, the humane cost associated with having grandparents or parents die without being able to see kids or grandchildren because of what Kyle mentioned, that children aren't allowed back in the infirmary areas or just in the prisons in general. And it makes absolute no sense. And I've actually got a quote, if I could read, from the report of one individual who just, I feel like, really summed this up by saying that it always baffled them when people that couldn't even sit up on their own would be denied the chance to die amongst the people they love and those that love them. I mean, we are talking about individuals who struggle and cannot do activities of daily life without assistance. So that means sitting up and just like using their body to support themselves in their bed, walking to the bathroom by their own, showering or using the toilet without assistance, even just feeding themselves. These individuals cannot do that without the support of medical staff and volunteers. And so everyone else has touched on the bills and all the other technicalities of this issue. And I think the thing that I just like to hone in is that this does not make sense. The status quo does not make sense. And I think it's pretty shameful that we, as a state, as voters, continue to allow this to happen under our watch.
And I'd just like to add another point with all of this is that the folks that are dying in prison, they're not necessarily individuals that were sentenced to life without parole in prison. So they are people who are sentenced to a set amount of time with the expectation that they were going to release. I agree with Justin, everyone here, that, you know, even for those individuals who are sentenced to life without parole and never expected to release, that there should be in our society that level of compassion and dignity and care for humanity that they be released and able to die amongst people that love and care about them. But it is such a tragedy, even more tragic, I mean, if it could be more tragic, when you are expecting to release in a couple of years, in some, you know, you know that you're getting out, but because of the medical conditions inside, because of some sort of, you know, medical condition that you have, you end up dying in prison because Oregon will not allow you to be released.
Yeah, you know, I mean, to me, it's going back to sort of the point that we were talking about earlier that I made, that, you know, when you examine the treatment of individuals in prison, what it is a reflection of our value system as a society and a reflection of who we are. And to think that we are collectively the general, you know, who we are. I know there's people who don't believe in this, but collectively as a society, because this is what's reflected in our laws, that we allow this to persist, like we allow these people to suffer unnecessarily and to live in a way that's within dignity. Like we force people into these circumstances. And then when we do have the moment and opportunities to be able to think about grace and compassion, we limit that, you know, and that is a limitation on ourselves, I think, more than anything. It has no reflection on the individuals. That is the whole point of compassion. Like, you give that grace and compassion without expectations, you know, to people. It's a very hard issue. You know, I've been glad that we've been able to work on it over the past several years. And I'm hopeful. Senator Dembrough seems very committed to, like, moving this. So hopefully we'll be successful this legislative session in getting it across the finish line. It'll take a lot of work and effort once it gets across. It is a complicated bill with a lot of moving parts. But it's also very simple, you know, in some ways. Conceptually, it's simple, but logistically, there's a lot of moving parts to it. But hopefully we can get it in place. And then once we get that infrastructure in place, there's a lot of changes that we hope to make to allow more eligibility in people who do have these Measure 11 crimes or mandatory minimum sentences. So we'll come back to this topic in as we move through to the session and into the session, so that way we can make it sort of front of mind for people.
And in more detail, we could share the bill specifics and stuff like that. Yeah.
And the complications in the bill, though, are because of all the restrictions that we as a state or community put on ourselves. This is one of those issues where there is clearly a different way that we can do things. It's not such some of the other sort of societal issues that we are grappling with that are such a magnitude, you know, that it takes a lot of different sectors of the community and actors and things like that to solve. This is very doable. And the reason the bill is complicated is because of the restrictions, and I think completely unnecessary restrictions, that we are just imposing on ourselves based on this, like, the wrong value system.
Yeah. And then going back to what we were talking about earlier, these fear-based mythologies that we've sort of convinced ourselves of as truths that prevent us from actually seeing the humanity in individuals.
Yeah, it's quite confounding that when the government doesn't even treat people with compassion and are, you know, enact callous and you know, vengeful laws and administrative rules and policies, it's just so surprising that the community doesn't reflect. You know, the community, the government should hopefully be, you know, I guess this is also talking about the death penalty, right? The government should be holding itself to, you know, and the society
the government should reflect the best possible values,
exactly.
our best selves, right. You know, because we need government to help hold us all to a higher standard, you know, and inspire us and be there for us and support us, you know, like that. That's sort of like the best sort of version of government.
Yeah, we have a long way to go.
We have a long way to go. But I think this is a nice way to wrap up, because next week, I'm not going to say that we're going to have Julia back on as a guest. I think she's just going to be a mainstay at the podcast. But we'll be back next week, and Julia will discuss the GIPR response that we just released. Mm. And I think, to your point of when the government acts in inappropriate ways and causes harm, and there's no acknowledgement of that harm, it's problematic. Like, and, you know, we'll talk specifically about the response to the GIPR report and what we believe it says and what the government should be doing or what the state should be doing and what it hasn't done. But, I just want to thank Kyle. You know, he'll be back and to join us on this podcast frequently, I hope. If you're around Oregon, I don't know, we'll post it on social media. Yes. I think there's like a map. Maybe we should have like a little, what is it, a geolocation tracker.
Yes.
For
yes.
Where is Kyle today?
A little tracker on the truck.
But Kyle Hedquist, he's a policy associate for OJRC, is on a road tour trying to go out to
Bend and Madras next week.
Central Oregon. Mm-hmm. Trying to connect with people in outside sort of the I-5 corridor. Mm-hmm. And trying to talk about these issues, his own experiences, and the work of OJRC. So be on the lookout if you have a small restaurant in these small communities.
I'll be stopping by.
Kyle will be stopping by. But I just want to thank Justin, Zach, Julia, Kyle, and as always, our producer, Todd Davila. And this is your trailblazing moment.
How has the lives of your clients informed your own humanity?
It's taught me that, you know, mercy is not something we give to people because they deserve it. Compassion is not something we offer to people because they're owed. It's what we do because it's the way we find mercy for ourselves. You can't get mercy unless you give it. You can't receive compassion unless you give it. And it's made me want to be merciful and compassionate. It's made me want to understand the people who are unhappy with me, who are hostile to me, who sometimes act as if they hate me. I used to get death threats and bomb threats. And it's made me not want to believe that the people behind those threats are just enemies or haters or bigots. It's made me recognize that they're like my clients. They need someone to kind of get past what's created this burden, this fear, this anger, this hostility.
It's really fear.
It really is fear. Yeah. Absolutely.